WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Susie Ahn, in for Sasha Ann Simons. This is Reset. It's Friday. That means it's time to take a look back at the last few days and the top local stories you should know but might have missed. Sit back for our weekly news recap. We're bringing you the latest headlines from new state laws.
Eligible undocumented immigrants can apply for standard driver's licenses in Illinois.
To changes that could affect your wallet.
The gas tax will rise by 2 cents to 47 cents a gallon. That's the second highest in the nation.
To pay rising in Chicago.
This is the sixth time minimum wage has increased over the past 5 years.
I sat down with a panel of journalists to break it all down. Christian Farr, reporter of NBC 5 Chicago, Daniel Knowles, Midwest correspondent for The Economist, and WBEZ city politics reporter Mariah Wolfel. On July 1st, we saw several new statewide and Chicago laws go into effect, so I started off by asking Mariah about changes to minimum wage. Here's Mariah.
Yeah, several new laws, including in Chicago. In Chicago, that minimum wage increased to $16.20 an hour. And in Illinois, overall minimum wage is now at $14 an hour, I believe. And this applies to companies, at least in Chicago, businesses with four or more employees. So one of several laws actually going into effect July 1st affecting workers in the city.
Well, in addition to that, tipped workers also got a boost in their hourly minimum wage. What are those details?
Yeah, so, you know, this was a big push by Mayor Brandon Johnson and the city council that took effect July 1st as well. Tipped workers have made a sub-minimum wage in the city of Chicago. Their employers, if tips don't make them whole to minimum wage, are supposed to cover that difference, but that doesn't always happen. And tipping can all, sometimes be inequitable based on your identity. And so women, people of color, are seen to be tipped less than their white or male counterparts. And so part of the solution to that, or the effort to fix that, is increasing tipped worker wage. Right now, it's a phase in or a phase out of the sub-minimum wage. On July 1st, it went up to $11.02 per hour, and this will gradually increase over 5 years so that it's at parity with where the minimum wage will be at in 5 years as well.
And we've seen a little bit of this with some restaurants in the city getting ahead of this and trying it out for themselves ahead of this. Christian, do you think diners will see higher menu prices as a result of the wage increase?
I think so. And I mean, I think some people are even still reporting having those COVID surcharges that are still on their bills, even though we've kind of passed through that. So, yeah, I think that's going to come over in time. I mean, Chicago is a big restaurant town. We still have restaurants that are still trying to recover from all of this, or even had closed during COVID. So, yeah, I think it's going to be passed on to the customer. I just think we're going to see that. It's unavoidable.
Yeah. Well, Mariah, do you think wait staff are concerned that customers might tip less as a result of this wage increase?
Yeah. So the campaign One Fair Wage is made up of tipped workers who do support this increase, but there are many tipped workers who spoke out against it, including in city council meetings, who say, I make a livable wage. I make even more than the minimum wage. Some restaurants say my employees make $35 an hour with tips. And the concern is that once the word starts to spread that tipped workers do get paid a minimum wage, that patrons of restaurants won't feel it's necessary to tip them to make up for that. And oftentimes, you know, servers report that, like, yeah, the tips that they do get are generous and that they make more than minimum wage anyways. I, for one, am going to be tipping, regardless of whether this minimum wage increase comes or not, because serving is difficult.
Yeah,
and minimum wage is really hard to live by.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there is a big tipping culture in America. And I know that some people have kind of reached tipping fatigue with, it just seems like everywhere you turn around, you get a screen with it just starts at 20%. That's where it starts. Daniel, is tipping as common in most European countries as it is in the US?
Oh, not at all. In the UK, we tend to tip in restaurants, but like 10 to 12% is normal. And certainly when you're a Brit here, you feel like you have to almost tip more because, you know, the expectation is that you're going to be cheap. So you have to sort of signal, no, really? I know. I think the tipping kind of changed in that, you know, the rise in wages in restaurants has been happening actually kind of across the board. And I almost wonder at this point how much the minimum wage really matters, because what happened in COVID is so many people who were waiters who worked in the restaurant industry got other jobs and haven't come back. And so I think kind of restaurants would be raising wages, you know, before tips, even if it weren't for this law. They are in Indiana, you know, where the minimum wage is still $7. So I think there's a lot of griping about this that perhaps is just, you know, it's the underlying economics, not the law.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have to see how that plays out. Well, employees will also benefit from a new law expanding paid leave. Mariah, what are the details on that?
Yeah, so this applies to people who work 80 hours or more in a 120-day period. And that basically accounts for people who come to Chicago for temporary work, like setting up a convention, for instance, maybe a Democratic National Convention, where they would still be covered to get 5 days of sick leave and 5 days of vacation. That's double what is required at the state level as part of their paid PTO law that's going into effect. And so another one of kind of Mayor Brandon Johnson's first priorities in office, the city gave businesses 6 months to kind of adapt to this after some negotiations that were a bit fraught at times.
Yeah, that's a good benefit package there. Well, in addition to that new law, another new law, undocumented residents will now be able to get an official driver's license. And this is, it's not quite just the standard. It is limited. Mariah, what are the details of that?
So this replaces a temporary license process, and now undocumented residents can get their full driver's license. You have to be you have to prove that you've lived in the state of Illinois for at least 1 year and also provide proof of car insurance. This can't help you get a real ID or vote as an undocumented resident, but it will, you know, give you that stability of having a permanent driver's license.
Yeah, and Christian, clearly not having an ID is a big obstacle, and so this will be a major change for undocumented residents in Chicagoland.
Yeah, I mean, the migrant immigration issue has been big. I mean, long before, you know, we had these migrants being shipped here as a sanctuary city. So this is a discussion that's been going on, and I think a lot of those organizations that have been fighting for this use this opportunity with this sanctuary city and all these migrants coming here to use this as an opportunity to sort of push this conversation forward. So, you know, we'll have to see what comes out of it. So many people take advantage of it, but I know that there's a lot of people that have been in this country for, you know, two decades or more, and have been working under the table, and now, you know, they really want to be considered citizens here because they've been benefiting from being in the U.S. and also giving back to the U.S. as well. So I know it's a big discussion that's been going on.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's just in time for the busiest travel weekend of the summer. We're going to have to pay a little more at the pump, it turns out. Daniel, what happened with the state's gas tax?
Oh, it's going up 3 cents, I believe. I have to admit, I've not paid huge attention to this because I don't drive, but Illinois has, you know, I think 10 years ago actually had one of the lower gas taxes in the country, and it's now rising. And I think that reflects the fact that, you know, there's quite a lot of road maintenance, and it's a tight budget. And, you know, the gas tax wasn't really covering much of the cost of maintaining roads. There aren't a lot of toll roads in the state compared to elsewhere. So, you know, putting up the gas tax is one of the things J.B. Pritzker has that helps fill that budget deficit. So I think it will probably keep going up, maybe not quite as fast in the future as it has done the last 5-6 years.
Yeah, and I believe it's 2 cents, which may not sound like much, but you know, as you were saying, in the last, when you compare it to the last several years, you know, the gas tax has increased substantially. If we look at 2017, it was 19 cents a gallon, and now 40 cents a gallon in Illinois, for those taxes. Daniel, how does this compare to gas taxes, let's say, in the UK?
Oh, Americans would go complete. There would be a revolution, you know? I think petrol prices, as we would call it, petrol, they're actually lower than they were kind of 10 years ago, and you adjust for inflation, or 20 years ago. But, you know, we used to paying, I guess, like two, I never drove at home either, but I think like £2 or £3 a litre. So that's sort of $3 to $4 a litre. So that's, I guess, I don't know, it's probably over $10 a gallon.
The metric system doesn't work for us, but right. What you're saying is a lot.
It's more in the UK to know that.
But people's cars are a lot more efficient. My sister has a car that does something like 75 miles to the gallon. So, just people drive much smaller cars
that's true.
A lot of hybrids and things.
So. And like 2 cents, it doesn't sound like a lot, but we all know that we'll drive like 5 more blocks to get to the gas station that has 2 cents cheaper per gallon.
We will drive to the next suburb over.
Yeah, exactly. Or we'll drive to Indiana.
Yeah. Using all of the gas that we
or that we like saved. I did 5 years ago, switched to electric. And they still charge you more, when you got to register the car. So yes,
absolutely.
Yeah, it hurts in Illinois.
That's not the only tax hike we've got. We've got the increase in the sports betting tax. And it is much more significant. Christian, fill us in on that.
Yeah, that's FanDuel and DraftKings. This is coming from JB. And the Illinois General Assembly last week passing a net revenue tax that, keeps it under 40%, but it's up 15% from that flat rate that they had before. So, these are two big betting giants who've been making millions in the state of Illinois. There's even been economists who have said, look, if they decide to exit the state, they're ridiculous. Let the door hit them on their back because they're making a lot of money. And so there's no indication that they can't pay this increased tax. If you just look at the amount of advertising that's done on TV by both FanDuel and DraftKings, not even when a game is on, they do so much advertising. So they are making millions in this state, and there's no indication that they're going to exit Illinois because of this increase.
Yeah, and it's a graduated tax too, and so those two companies make the most in Illinois, and so they will pay the most. But if you look at their revenue last year, the Sun-Times, Mitch Armantrout had a great story on this. FanDuel made nearly $411 million in revenue. DraftKings, $319 million. Wow. He interviewed some experts who said that states, when they legalize sports betting, tend to under-tax because they want to promote the industry. They want to promote sports betting in the state. But that, when you look at states like New York that are taxing sports betting online at 51%, it's really trying to get the early, less mature industry states up to par with how much you can tax these massively profitable industries. And so I read the same quote that was like, if they're going to leave, then let the door hit them out the way out, because they are making hundreds of millions off of a service that can be highly addictive to the people in the state. And some of this revenue, you'd imagine, this tax revenue goes to paying for addiction services for the, products that they provide.
Yeah, do you think, of course there's dissatisfaction amongst those giants like FanDuel and DraftKings for this tax increase. But is it all talk when they threaten that they would leave over these taxes?
I think so. There's way too much money being made here. And I don't see it going away anytime soon. And, when this was being discussed years ago, I remember doing a lot of stories on what's the impact going to be on people who have a gambling addiction. And you're bringing this in and making it even worse. The whole casino conversation as well. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they're exiting. There's too much money being made here, and they can afford to pay this.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, not to make you the what's it like somewhere else?
But we should, right?
Yeah. The betting scene in the UK.
Well, betting's going long established in the UK. And when I first lived here I lived in DC before I lived in Chicago about 10 years ago. And of course, at that point, it was very difficult to gamble on sports anywhere in this country. And I went away and I came back again. And now it feels like people are more addicted, that gambling on sports here has completely overtaken what I was kind of used to. I mean, it's a big thing at home too, but I think it's more of a, I think there's less insanity around it. And although there was just a huge bunch of controversy and politics at home about politicians betting on their own election outcomes. So, but it's been wild to see how much gambling spread here. And I think, you know, it's a bit like marijuana legalization. It's one of those things where state governments have realized, gosh, we can make a lot of money doing this. And if we don't, then our citizens are only going to be spending that money in the next state over anyway. So so suddenly, sort of, once one place does it, everywhere does it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, sticking with all that money, but now turning to less money or lack of Chicago's unfunded pension debt, which went up another 5% to more than $37 billion. Mariah, I mean, it's a big problem, but just break it down for us. How big of a problem is this for taxpayers?
Well, it's huge because, you know, this is only growing year over year. We talk about it every year, but it's hard to imagine, you know, how we're going to continue to pay for our pension debt each year, which is, you know, nearing $3 billion as an annual payment. Without some sort of intervention in terms of new revenue, in the form of new taxes or, you know, a property tax increase, which Mayor Brandon Johnson has said that he doesn't want to do during his 4 years. But of course, that is his first 4 years. But of course, that is part of the problem of why we're in this crisis in the first place, was because raising property taxes is very unpopular. And so there are many mayors in Chicago history who forewent those property tax increases, especially in election years, and, you know, shortchanged our pension system. And so our pensions are extremely underfunded. The firefighters pension fund hovers closest to bankruptcy, with assets to cover just 21.6% of liabilities. So that's basically, if I owe you $100, I only have 20 of it. So I'm missing 80. And our other pension funds hover around the 20% mark as well. And experts say that pension funds, public pension funds, should be funded no less than at 80%. And so we have a really long way to go. We have to get up to 90% at a certain point by state statute. And so it is a big problem. There's a working group, a pension working group, that Johnson created to kind of try to find long-term solutions to this crisis. And we haven't heard much from them yet. They've been meeting for about a year. And so hopefully something shakes loose in this budget season. Johnson is continuing a Lightfoot, a former Mayor Lori Lightfoot era policy that puts an advance payment to our pension system. So it's basically like not paying the minimum on your credit card. You're paying a little bit more than that minimum. It's a smart, very like popular policy amongst fiscal experts. And so he is continuing that. That's good news. And we'll see what else is up his sleeve.
Yeah. Any idea when we'll hear any sort of recommendations from that working group?
I don't know what, if they're statutorily required or, you know, required by ordinance to provide anything. I don't have the answer to that, but you'd imagine with this news coming out that it has, you know, increased by more than 5% again, that they'll want to say something soon. And then, of course, budget season starts in earnest kind of in October. And so that these conversations will start back up again.
Governor Pritzker joined other Democratic governors for a meeting with the president on Wednesday. Mariah, there are a lot of nervous Democrats right now. Did it seem like Biden reassured Pritzker and other governors?
Well, Pritzker himself is kind of walking this fine line of being a committed Biden supporter and one of the most vocal, obviously, as the governor of the state that's hosting the Democratic National Convention. That's the position you are in. But also being a potential presidential hopeful if, you know, Biden does step out, and with his, even if it's not this year, has his own presidential ambitions. And so has to consider that when he's making comments about a president who more and more voters don't see fit for office. And so, you know, Pritzker's comments have sounded a lot like what we just heard, which is like, he said, my word is my bond. Biden's going to be our nominee unless he decides otherwise. You know, like, I support him unless he makes a different decision. And so, you know, I'm not sure what went on in that meeting or what's going to transpire. Obviously, I'm not sure over the next few days, but I don't think we'll get any indication from Pritzker otherwise, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Christian, how do you think other Illinois Democrats are feeling about the August convention right now?
I think it's very iffy across the board. I don't think it's just Illinois. I think it's across the country. And I mean, this was the subject of conversation during my July 4th hanging out with family. I mean, you know, there are 50% of us saying that he's going to stay in the race. There's the other 50% that are saying he needs to drop out and there's going to be another candidate. So, I mean, this is going to be history in the making, depending on even no matter what direction you go in. That debate performance was difficult to watch. But, you know, history tells us that, you know, Barack Obama had a bad debate performance at one point. Reagan had a bad debate performance. Do we all, you know, rested on that? But, you know, he is a man of advanced age and it didn't look good, you know, just superficially what we saw up there. And so I think a lot of people are wondering behind the scenes publicly. They're not going to say it, but behind the scenes, I think there's a lot of concern.
Yeah, and that August convention is fast approaching. Well, J.B. Pritzker, as we've mentioned, is one of the politicians sometimes mentioned as a possible alternate Democratic nominee. Daniel, you've been doing a deep dive into another politician many think is a leading alternate candidate, Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Why the growing interest in her?
Well, you know, funnily, I think a lot of it is the same as J.B. Pritzker. She's a Midwestern governor who has done a lot of progressive things. I think what, you know, when you talk to kind of Democratic strategists and ask about the two, they say, well, Whitmer did it in a state that was, you know, controlled by three Republican, like Republican tripartites, you know, not that long ago. And she's kind of won election, then won a big re-election, helped get a first, you know, helped get the Democrats back into the state House and Senate. She's been like an abortion rights sort of person since she first entered the Michigan State House in 2000. You know, that's been one of her big messages for a long time. So I think that's, you know, people would like her to sell that nationally. I think what, you know, certainly what where I am with my reporting, I'm not sure. I think she absolutely has presidential ambitions, but whether she has them for this year yet, I think is unclear. I think she's quite cautious and, you know, 2028 is what she's got her eye on.
But absolutely. I think right now everybody's just, we're a little bit on shaky ground. I don't want to reveal my cards just yet. Well, President Biden is in the Midwest today. Daniel, what is he up to?
So he's in Madison and he's giving a speech. I think it's, you know, part of me, I possibly should have been up there, but
but
no, our DC correspondents are asking about it. But he's, you know, I think people are going to be watching to see whether he shows, you know, more energy, more of a sense of that he can kind of keep on with this campaign. It's one of a bunch of campaign events he's got over this weekend, but you have to wonder what, you know, the big conversations that are obviously happening behind the scenes. That's certainly what my colleagues are all sort of obsessed with. The Economist cover this week is about how Biden ought to step down. So, yeah. But I think he's under a lot of pressure to show, you know, that if he is going to keep campaigning, that he has the energy and can persuade people he'll be able to go for, you know, potentially another 4 years. So,
of course, we'll all be watching. We'll all be spending our Friday night watching his ABC interview at 7 p.m. tonight, right? I mean, friends? Yeah.
Got it on my calendar. Well, I mean, Daniel, you mentioned that your own publication, The Economist, called for Biden to step aside. So have the editorial boards at a number of U.S. newspapers, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune. I mean, does this seem pretty historic, especially in terms of how the world views the U.S.?
I think there's an enormous amount of anxiety about the possibility of Donald Trump coming back into office, particularly in Europe. You know, since the war in Ukraine broke out, there's been just deep fear that, you know, American support for Ukraine and against Russia might sort of diminish under a Trump presidency. Elsewhere too, you know, I mean, Taiwan as well. So I think everybody has been kind of watching, you know, the Biden campaign with that kind of trepidation of, well, this man has, you know, been a good ally, but he's won. He came in 2020, but he's 81 years old, and what if he doesn't again? That's been, you know, the view from outside, I think, for a while, but obviously nobody really, it's hard to know quite how up to it he is. And obviously at times he looks very sharp, and other times he looks like he did at the debate last week.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking about the presidential election. Daniel, you mentioned that at your July 4th celebration, you had everybody watch the election returns for Great Britain. Tell us a little bit about the results. And I mean, I'm sure you've been following this from here in Chicago.
It was a Labour landslide. They have taken a huge majority. So the Labour Party, who were last in office in 2010, came back to power. It was quite a strange result overall. It was exactly what was predicted, but they won a landslide majority on 36% of the vote. There were a lot of, you know, third, fourth, fifth parties action in this election. The real story was essentially the collapse of the Conservative Party, which has, you know, run Britain for 13 years. And I think, you know, has seen by a lot of people not to have done a very good job at this point. So they, if anything, there were some worries that they would possibly be almost completely wiped out as a party. And they did manage to keep 120 odd seats, which still means they're the second party. But it's devastating for them. It's a huge, huge defeat.
What do you think were some of the tension points over the past several years for the Conservative Party to kind of start to crumble?
Well, some of it is, you know, the same things that I think Joe Biden's struggling with here. It's inflation that soared all over the world. It's this sense that, you know, after the pandemic, that things just aren't working as well. But the British economy has really underperformed for over a decade now. So many American friends who are traveling to Europe and particularly to the UK now, because the dollar has been so much stronger and the American economy has really outperformed. So, and Britain really hasn't, and people feel poor and they feel fed up, and the health service isn't working. Lots of public services aren't working. I think there's just a real kind of sense that the country's been kind of stagnating for some time now.
And before we head to break, I really just want to ask you about this betting scandal that was around this election.
So it turned out that the Prime Minister's his chief of security, as well as several MPs, a lot of MPs were all betting on, you know, when the election would happen. Some of them with the inside information of, you know, the fact the Prime Minister was going to call it. Others were just betting on themselves. It's become a huge thing, betting in politics in Britain. And I think suddenly everybody sort of noticed this was happening, and particularly people betting on things that they knew were going to happen. It's not the Gambling Commission has, you know, which regulates gambling in the UK, has kind of came in, and some people have been arrested. So it's suddenly become a criminal thing, and it was this kind of quite, you know, I think it will be forgotten about now the election's over, but it was definitely a fun thing that people betting on themselves to lose. One MP bets several thousand pounds on wow, him losing his own seat. So
that is fascinating. I almost feel like in the US we look at a scandal like that and think, oh, that's quaint. Could it happen here? I mean, it's not good, but it's still like, I don't know. Should I say I enjoy hearing something?
I mean, what they need to do is start making tax revenue off of politics.
There you go.
Yes. Yes. They'll uphold some of these economies that are crumbling, but you know,
absolutely,
it's another story.
The 4th of July parade returned to North Suburban Highland Park 2 years after a mass shooting. Christian, this must have been a difficult event for the town to organize.
Yeah, I think it was. I just remember that 2 years ago, being at home. Just July 4th reporting is simply going to a ton of parades around the city, around the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And then to get that call to head to Highland Park, and I only live 15, 20 minutes from it. And so this year was the return of that parade that did not happen last year. And this was a somber but celebratory moment to remember those individuals who died and the many that were injured during that. But it was also a lot of heavy security as well, because of what happened 2 years ago. This shooter, who I think we try to tend not to mention the shooter's name as much, because a lot in these mass shootings, we mention the shooter's name, that's what becomes remembered, and the victims become forgotten. So, and he's still going through his court proceedings. proceedings right now. But it was a somber day, but it was also a day to celebrate those people who were lost, those people who were injured, heavy security as well. My colleagues were out there covering it. But, you know, it immediately takes you back to that day where there was just chaos, people wondering where their children were, where their family members were, and those who just, one of the victims went to that parade, did not go there with his family. He just went there by himself, and the family had to get a phone call later to find out exactly what happened. Hopefully, you know, this continues in Highland Park, you know, to sort of take back what was lost. I think it, you know, it was natural for them not to have it last year. But, you know, the mayor says they wanted to be strong. It's Highland Park strong. And it's just to sort of continue that that tradition that had been going on for so many years. People felt like it was just damaged after this all happened.
Yeah, and from my colleagues reporting, I hear that it was, of course, not as well attended as it has been in the past. Folks going to the parade, but you know, of course, feeling nervous. But in some ways, a triumph of being able to come back to that tradition. Well, you know, this week the Supreme Court declined to hear a challenge to Illinois' assault weapons law, which came out of that Highland Park tragedy. Christian, what were the challenges to the ban?
Yeah, they decided not to do this because I believe that Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, had said we need to figure out what weapons are covered under the Second Amendment. Now, this doesn't mean that this is over. This can come back. The gun rights advocates say, you know, we may have to go back, but in Highland Park and for all of the people who are fighting to keep this ban in place, they consider this to be a celebratory moment. But, you know, challenges are going to keep coming. There are, you know, the gun rights advocate just sector of this country is very, very strong, very, very powerful, especially here in the state as well, downstate. And so there's going to be a huge push to get this back onto the Supreme Court's docket and to get them to discuss this. You know, they'll change that argument and see exactly what happens. But there's also going to be a fight on the other side to keep this assault weapons ban in place.
Yeah. And this was, I think they were reviewing an appeal for a preliminary or a request for a preliminary injunction. And so Thomas specifically said once a final decision is made, this may come back to the Supreme Court. And he even went so far as to say, quote, ultimately, this allows Illinois' ban. If the federal appeals court in Chicago allows Illinois to ban America's most common civilian rifle, we can and should review that decision once the cases reach a final judgment. And so that seems to be a strong indication from the Supreme Court itself that they are expecting this case to come back up.
Yeah, so challenges possibly ahead, but for now, that ban will stay in place. Shifting to a different parade, last weekend was Chicago's Pride Parade. It was scaled down, but still, by most accounts, a success. However, there were 59 arrests. I mean, Christian, is this to be expected when hundreds of thousands of people show up for an event? It's just going to happen.
I mean, this is an ever-changing parade. I used to work on Sundays for about 15 years. And while I did not usually attend the parade to cover it because I worked in the evening, there was always something that was happening afterwards. There's a big party that happens in Montrose right after this parade goes on. And there have been issues. I know several years ago before the pandemic, there were a lot of arrests that happened during that party. So, and, you know, they've changed the route several times. They've shortened the route. They've changed the time for the parade. You know, it's a very large scale parade. I mean, you look at Lollapalooza. That's something else that's huge as well. And that has been adjusted over the years for security purposes when we have severe weather that comes in or people who decide to, you know, take drugs and go in there and be in the heat. And you have a lot of issues.
Yep.
This is, I think, the Pride Parade is going to be ever changing, unfortunately. But, you know, it's a celebratory event in the city. It's something that people look forward to. People fly in from out of the country to come to this parade. It's not something that's going to go away anytime soon, but it has to be controlled in a way that it's safe in the city because we've got a lot going on this summer. I mean, that's just one thing. Mm-hmm. We've got NASCAR, which is causing goodness, really, yes. really big issues right now, yes. traffic wise. And that's not going to go away anytime soon either. And you got Lollapalooza coming and Taste of Chicago and a bunch of other things as well.
Yeah. Well, we are going to talk a little bit about NASCAR in just a sec. But Mariah, you know, the with how things were controlled, you know, pretty well controlled at the Pride Parade. Do these arrests raise any questions about how Chicago police will be able to handle the crowds of possible protesters for the DNC in August?
Well, you know, I don't think these arrests are what are prompting those questions. We don't need any more than to look back at the 2020 protests and you know, looting and rioting that followed the murder of George Floyd. And I think police have said that they have tried to take lessons from that. They were found to have, you know, abused their power and, you know, documented civil rights violations that have caused the city to pay out millions to people who have sued for police department's behavior during those protests. This is a major conversation right now. The Sun-Times' Tom Shuba has been doing a lot of good coverage on negotiations between the so-called Consent Decree Coalition and CPD. And the Consent Decree Coalition is basically just a group of community groups that has been working with the city on court-ordered reforms of the Chicago Police Department, which have been ongoing for years. And they said initially CPD's mass arrest policy around the DNC, that's what they're working on, the policy that they drafted and came out with would eviscerate First Amendment rights. CPD then went back, came out with a new draft, and the coalition did say that the latest draft on file does have various improvements, including a change that bans the controversial strategy of kettling, which mm-hmm. is basically, you know, decreasing a crowd more and more until you can, you know, seclude them in a certain area where you can't really yeah. escape, which causes a lot of anxiety, can cause anxiety attacks for people, but you get them the crowd down to where you can arrest, you know, a couple dozen people. So this policy would ban kettling. It also prohibits officers from arresting people for minor offenses. But there are still a lot of concerns, including that the coalition says it doesn't sufficiently ban police officers from using pepper spray. And it doesn't differentiate, this is a kind of a big one, I'd say, between a legal protest in the form of civil disobedience mm-hmm. Versus illegal acts such as looting or, you know, rioting or, you know, mass property destruction. Right. Those are two different strategies that I think, you know, the differentiation between those two will be important for the DNC. And so that's kind of the broader outlook that will continue to play out in the next, you know, month until
yeah,
we're there.
Until it happens.
It's amazing.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, shifting gears, we are entering what I like to call hot traffic summer. I got two words for anyone coming downtown over the holiday weekend: public transportation. So downtown museums and parks will be open during NASCAR's Chicago Street Race, but there will be plenty of road closures. Daniel, what do people need to know if they're coming downtown?
I'm listening.
I don't know if there's a good answer there.
Stay away.
I mean, I think, you know, obviously, like, if you can come down in public transport, that probably makes sense. You come on a bicycle. One thing I've noticed a lot of in the last, you know, this summer so far is how many more people are on bicycles in Chicago. It's really, you know, I mean, the infrastructure's improved, but you also have, I think, you know, driving is hellish, and also the CTA is not working like you'd like it to. So I think, honestly, that's one of the good options left. That's how I got here today. maybe check it out, especially if the weather's good.
Well, I mean, what are your general thoughts on just the NASCAR event in general?
So I wasn't here for it last year. I was actually trapped in New York City at the time complete weather chaos. Mm-hmm. But I gather it was a complete washout. I think that, you know, if you look at a lot of the events that the city of Chicago kind of organizes, you know, for essentially revenue reasons, somebody ought to be doing a good analysis of what works better, because I think, you know, you could look at, say, Lollapalooza and NASCAR and say, well, one of these is much less disruptive and raises a lot more money for the city than the other. And so it sort of strikes me that, you know, when the city has to raise money, it's got all these different assets and it's giving up public spaces, you know, parks and the rest to raise money. And I wonder with NASCAR whether there's a you know, systematic thinking about whether this makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And just a reminder, those street closures include sections of DuSable Lakeshore Drive, Michigan Avenue, Columbus Drive, and Roosevelt Road. I mean, you know, there was just a terrible storm last year. So it's almost like this is a redo. Christian, do you think that that streetcar race being broadcast around the world is a chance for Chicago to shine?
I don't know. It's a different type of race, right? I mean, it's a street race. It's in the city of Chicago. We've got a wonderful skyline. I mean, that's all well and good. But I remember talking to an alderman last year about the NASCAR street race, and the hotels weren't sold out before the race happened. So that it wasn't the revenue generator they thought it was going to be. And there was really a whole lot of speculation that is it even going to come back? But he was pretty confident that it was going to come back because they were storing all of their stuff in Indiana in preparation for them to bring it back here for this year. And as we see, it's back. I was coming from Evanston and Lakeshore Drive was down to one lane. I mean, and Lakeshore Drive, when it's got multiple lanes open, is bad enough when you have it down to one lane. So, you know, I mean, I remember doing a lot of stories leading up to all of this. And the suggestion was, hey, if you don't have to be in the city during this time, don't come here, you know, except for all of us who have to work downtown every once in a while. So, you know, public transportation, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of complaints about CTA going on right now. So, you know, a bike might be the best way to do it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the 4th of July usually marks the peak of summer travel, and this year has been one of the busiest for travel. O'Hare and Midway are expecting more than 1.75 million passengers over the long holiday weekend. And Daniel, you've been looking at American travel habits. What have you found?
Well, it's not as big as a trend as I would have liked, but what you can see in the data is that Americans are finally beginning to take more vacation. You know, you had for decades a kind of decline, and certainly, you know, I my wife has an American employer, and so gets a lot less vacation than me. Like, oh, what am I going to do with these extra weeks? But you can see what you can see if you look through is that, you know, Americans are entitled to more vacation and are beginning to take just a little bit more. They're traveling a lot more, you know, you can see this if you're in national parks. I was recently in Zion National Park in Utah, and you have to, you know, apply for permits and things to do certain hikes, or, you know, some of them even to get in. You have to really plan ahead because there are a lot more people traveling, and there are people working out how to use, you know, working from home to extend, you know, a long weekend into something longer, that sort of thing. So it's tricky to get my head around all the data, but I think, you know, it's certainly particularly the kind of Americans who can work from home, who can kind of use days to bridge, that sort of thing, are finding that, you know, there's a lot of catching up to do on vacation time, and they're still doing it. So,
yeah, I've seen this working from vacation situation happening. I haven't done it, but I have seen people do it. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting one. Yeah. Well, we are coming to the close of the news recap, but not before we mention that Chicago has a new claim to fame. Mm-hmm. Chicagoan Patrick Bertoletti came in first place at Nathan's 4th of July hot dog eating contest held each year at New York's Coney Island. Pause for dramatic effect. Mm-hmm. He ate 58 hot dogs in 10 minutes. This is not the first victory for the 39-year-old, known competitively as Deep Dish. In 2015, he won the Wing Bowl by eating 444 chicken wings in half an hour.
With hot sauce? Or?
You know, that might be a strategy. I don't know.
I believe it's bone-in. They have a technique that they eat those with.
Yes, they do.
I'm only familiar with this because I used to work in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia, you know, you talk about the Cubs having the long, you know, this long drought. Well, Philadelphia as a city had a very long drought for any sports team. So we started to celebrate the Wing Bowl. And so we would go cover it like it was a sporting event. And then I saw that there was a technique.
There is
to
a
eating
technique.
Wings off of a bone.
With the hot dogs. I think you have to separate them. And I don't know, this sounds gross. I think you soak the buns in water.
Yes, you soak the buns in water. Yeah.
It just sounds horrific.
58 of them.
Well, I will say, so in addition to winning the title, Patrick Bertoletti won $10,000. So on our way out here, panelists, how much would they have to pay you to eat 58 hot dogs in 10 minutes?
Honestly, I love doing epic things like that.
So you're saying you would just do it for free?
Yeah,
for
I might just do it to see. I might do it this weekend to see how many hot dogs I can eat. But if you had to soak the bun in water,
I would
need money for that.
So for free for Mariah, just for the thrill. Christian, do you have a price?
Oh man, it's a lot more than $10,000.
Really?
I tell you, I love hot dogs too. I love them better than hamburgers,
but not like that.
Yeah. To soak them in water? I'm just thinking about the next day. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about.
Daniel?
It's like a visit to White Castle.
I just don't think I could deliver on the promise. I would fail. You know, I would sign this contract and they'd end up not paying me at all.
Yeah, well, we'll have to leave it there. I'll say I'll do it for $25,000. Sure, I'll do that.
Okay.
Well, that is it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to NBC5 Chicago's Christian Farr, WBEZ's Mariah Wolfel, and Daniel Knowles of The Economist. Enjoy your weekend, folks.
This episode of The Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Max Lubers. We know that getting caught up on the news can feel like a lot. That's why we dive into the biggest stories in the week, all in less than an hour. But if you want some quick updates throughout the week, consider signing up for a newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays and gives you the news you need to know along with the best of Chicago's culture. Subscribe at wbez.org/reset. I'm Susie Ahn, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.